like Netflix or Amazon Prime. Businesses where once a customer engages with them, it becomes automatic and a part of their lifestyle from then on. But how do you build that forever transaction? I'm Robbie Kelman-Baxter, and I have been studying subscription and membership models for nearly 20 years. In this podcast, my guests and I share the secrets and strategies of the membership economy. Join us for Subscription Stories, True Tales from the Trenches. One of the great mysteries for me is why so many otherwise sophisticated companies don't focus on involuntary churn. Also known as passive churn or accidental churn, involuntary churn happens when a payment issue raises a flag that causes a merchant to cancel a customer's subscription. In 70% of these cases, there is no fraud, so the company is literally turning away excellent customers. Involuntary churn routinely impacts about 10% of ARR, according to some estimates. In today's episode, Vijay Menon, founder and CEO of Butter Payments, and I discuss what drives involuntary churn, why so many companies underinvest in this problem, and some key tactics to drive revenue growth through better payment management. Vijay, welcome to the show.
Wonderful to meet you, Robbie. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to have you as a guest because we're going to dig into a topic that I think is so important for so many subscription professionals, which is involuntary churn. And I wanted to start, you're a real expert on this. How do you define involuntary churn? What is it?
We actually like to call it, and it's known among the industry in many different ways. I think involuntary churn is the most obvious semantic way to describe it, but we describe it as accidental churn. And I've heard it described variously as passive churn or billing churn. But I think accidental churn kind of encompasses that the best, because the type of churn that I'm focused on solving and that any subscription business should be focused on solving is when a user truly has an intent to pay, a willingness to pay, but they don't have an ability to pay. And that's the way that I would define involuntary churn. It's the type of churn where you're saying, hey, Netflix, take my $9. I actually want access to the service. I guess it's $15 these days, not nine. Wishful thinking. But hey, Netflix, take my $15. And they can't get it because the card response comes back as a payment failure or transaction failure. And because of their inability to actually go get their payment from you, you get churned from the service. And so the right way to think about involuntary churn is basically the opposite of how you'd classically think about churn. In a classical churn scenario, I don't want the service anymore. And that's my active churn. And that's me saying, hey, I don't want Netflix. $15 is too much. I pine for the times when it was $9. And as a result, I'm going to call customer service or go to a downgrade cancellation flow. We are not talking about that when we talk involuntary churn. We're talking through, I've put my card on file or my payment method on file. You can't collect my payment. And your inability to process my payment is resulting in me not having access to the service. So that's how I think about involuntary churn.
I love how you explain that, and especially that bit at the end where you said, I want to pay, but you are not able to receive my payment as the vendor, as the merchant, and therefore you choose to end the relationship with me. What might be a reason for that to happen? Is the customer in this scenario a fraudster? Or are there more innocent ways that this can happen to somebody who actually does have the ability to pay, but somehow the wires are getting crossed?
That's a great question because there's no intentionality on either side. And I see that the world tends to view payment failure as a pretty binary problem, right? It's either very black or very white. The world today, I think, views payment failure more on the side of, well, any payment failure must be genuine payment failure. It must be fraud. Or if it's not fraud, the user probably has to call up their bank and go get something fixed. They don't acknowledge that actually there's an in-between world, to your point, Robbie, which is that there's innocuous payment failure. So not every payment failure is a legitimate user trying to pay for the service. However, what may surprise you is that roughly 70% of payment failures, across my experience, on large subscription platforms, and we're talking all shapes and sizes, but generally $100 million plus in recurring revenue is a good kind of fulcrum to think about. About 70% of the payment failure on those platforms is actually a genuine user trying to pay for the service, who's been caught, to use your words, with the wires crossed. And it can be anything from a configuration error with how payment is formatted and presented, which can be done a variety of ways, to even a very, very small vagary of how the system is set up. If you think about an example and where I got my foray into this world, not by thinking super, super actively about it, but by realizing that over at Microsoft back in 2013, we did something that was very engineering optimal, which was to run cron jobs or batch payment billings. And so we would say, hey, all the users who signed up for Xbox Live, right, and signed up today on called April 10th, they're going to get billed on May 10th. And we're going to go run a billing queue at 12 noon local time in Seattle, Washington. Well, Robbie, if I'd signed up from India, it wouldn't be 12 o'clock local time when they run my card. It would be 1:30 in the morning. And if the State Bank of India has issued this card, they're wondering what I'm doing swiping an Indian issued card in the United States at 1:30 in the morning. They're thinking that might be fraud. And you would want them to think that might be fraud because I don't want someone swiping my card in India at 1:30 in the morning at a gas station. And as a result of that, Microsoft's getting a fraud response. And when they get that fraud response, which is the result of optimal engineering design, any engineering manager will tell you the right way to run these payments is to build a cron job and consume the workers as fast as possible. So they're doing nothing wrong from a technical perspective, but because of the way the payment system is set up, they're actually false flagging a bunch of payments. And those are legitimate users who are going to then wake up in the morning and realize they can't play Halo anymore and wonder what's going on. And they can't call the State Bank of India to fix that. Microsoft's got to fix that for them. And it turns out there's dozens and actually hundreds and actually thousands of reasons why these payments fail. But to answer your question directly, there's about 70% of those payment failures are very innocuous scenarios like this. And about 30% are legitimately fraud or card testers or not even necessarily nefarious. It might just be that a card got stolen. Well, I don't want that card to be rerun if it was stolen. So we have to be really, really thoughtful around distinguishing between those cases that are remediable and fixable and innocuous, and those cases that aren't. But I think the industry basically views it as one way or another, and the industry mostly views 100% of those payment failures as unfixable. And that's something that we need to change. We need to start to realize that the majority of payment failure is actually innocuous and fixable. And we need to be really thoughtful around how we distinguish between those two cases.
So you started a company, Butter Payments, to really dig in on all of the many reasons that involuntary churn happens. Can you walk me through, you alluded to your time at Microsoft and working with Xbox team. I know you've worked at several different places where involuntary churn has reared its ugly head. Can you walk me through your journey of discovery that led you to the point where you said, I need to build a solution to solve this problem?
Absolutely. And it's the journey that spans across three different subscription organizations. In fact, in all three cases, $100 million plus in recurring revenue. These three particular cases happen to be B2C subscription businesses. But over the years, I've found that it's not just B2C subscription businesses that have this problem. It's B2B self-serve businesses where there's a lot of card volume on signups. So things Zoom, Figma, Notion, et cetera. And it's also direct-to-consumer brands, right, that ship boxes. Where actually you can imagine a payment failure is more salient. Because in a digital world, if a payment fails, well, we can continue giving you access to our product for a while without any physical repercussion. If I'm selling diapers, I'm going to notice the diapers are not here in 3 days. And we have to fix that problem really, really quickly. So it really applies across all those three scenarios. But to come back to my specific experience, as you mentioned, it's a journey of discovery, right? And I can imagine similar to your case, you didn't wake up in the crib and say, hey, one day I'm going to be the world's preeminent subscription expert, but you got there over a process of discovery. And I didn't wake up thinking from the crib that I was going to become a preeminent payments expert. But my path to getting there was involved with a couple of core interests for myself growing up. Those would be sports and video games. Sports got me very, very deep into statistics and understanding the why, and making arguments for sabermetrics and other kinds of tools. And I ended up getting a degree in statistics. And the video game aspect brought me to Xbox for my first job. And so between 2013 and 2016, I started diving deeply into the causes of churn, put on the retention side from a product perspective. And at the time, the industry was focused heavily around the type of churn we talked about up front, which is active churn, which is to say, hey, users will be stickier on a subscription service if they use that service more. This is true. If you're more engaged with playing games or adding friends or hours of activity, you're more likely to continue to stick on Xbox Live, just as if you watch 50 hours of movies a month, you're more likely to stay on Netflix than if you watch 50 minutes of movies a month. And so teams should be doing good work here. However, what was overlooked was that actually the leading driver, the single biggest cause of churn, was this involuntary churn or accidental churn. And at Microsoft, it was roughly 20% of the overall churn. I moved to Dropbox before their IPO back in 2016. And first thing I looked into, of course, was the accidental churn or the involuntary churn component. And this might obviously blow some minds, but I now see this as normal across the industry. At Dropbox, actually, at the time, more than half of the churn was involuntary or payment failure. It's about 55%. And I moved later on into my career into Scribd. And at Scribd, another 100 million plus subscription service on the consumer side, another massive black hole when it came to involuntary churn, to the point where roughly 40% of our transactions were being declined due to payment failure reasons at a transaction level. And this is really my process of discovery into saying, well, if these three large $100 million plus B2C subscription organizations have not gotten a full handle on solving accidental churn, and the biggest singular thing they've done within the organization to drive revenue is to fix this problem, there's a solution to build at scale here, and the market has not caught up. And that led me on my journey to building Butter.
So there are still companies that are not focusing on involuntary churn. And from my perspective, working with businesses that are often trying to optimize their existing subscription model, and particularly in the last year or two, retention has been such a big focus for so many businesses. It's baffling to me why organizations wouldn't do a deep dive into what's driving this accidental form of churn, of customer loss. What are the reasons? Assuming that these people, Xbox, Dropbox, Scribd, smart people work there, people who want to make money, people that are trying to do right by their shareholders, why would they not? What are the reasons that you see for why people don't invest in this accidental churn?
Well, that's a great question, actually very multi-layered. I would say this to begin with, and it's kind of as you've kind of heard of the experience here. I myself didn't really actively choose to get involved in the payments or involuntary churn space. So I think the first reason is because every organization would rather outsource payments because their smartest and their brightest people want to work on stuff that is core to the product and the value prop. If I'm at Netflix, I probably want to work on sourcing fantastic content. Or if I'm on the technical side, I probably want to work on building fantastic machine learning algorithms to recommend great content to Robbie and Vijay. I probably don't come to Netflix to say, well, I really want to work on transacting payments. And similarly, at Spotify, I want to work on music. And similarly, if I'm over on the Xbox team, I want to work on building a great video game product and getting more involved in that. And so most organizations are going to want to outsource payments, and their smartest people aren't necessarily even going to want to work on payments in the first place. And so if they have the opportunity to do that, they will do that. And as a person that has led back-end teams across not just payments, but I also led back-end teams across search and recommendations, I can see that firsthand. You know, when we go to outsource search or go to outsource recommendations, the organization throws some bloody elbows up because the people in-house want to work on that stuff. It's core to their identity and their algorithms. Nobody is fighting to own any part of the payment stack. They're ready to outsource it. So I think there's an interest thing there first. That is just foundationally makes sense from a human perspective. But what I would say beyond that, and to get even more layered into like why are organizations looking at it, the first piece is they need to realize how big the problem is. So most organizations view failed payments as like a minor cost of doing business. Now when I go have a conversation with someone, it's in a large subscription organization, even all the way up to the finance suite, they're kind of broadly aware about involuntary churn and failed payments. They don't have a clue how big it is. They think it's roughly 1% to 2% of top line, and maybe you can get a little bit back, but the majority of it has been fixed. And they just assume that there's not a whole lot they can do there. Now, the reality is that when I go into organizations and I pull data directly from their payment service providers, 95% of cases, I find a minimum of 10% of the organization's top line revenue has gone into a failed payments bucket in the last year. Be very, very concrete about that. If it's a $100 million business, 95% of the time, sight unseen, I can guarantee there's been $10 million in failed payments volume in the last year at an invoice level. And I think if there was broad awareness of that, then everyone would say this is the number one thing I should be doing, right? Because if I can say, hey, $100 million business has $10 million in failed payments and we can probably give you $5 million back, and I can say that, and I am saying that, then I think most organizations would say that 5% ARR lift is probably the number one activity I'm going to prioritize this year. And again, I can say that having been on A/B testing teams and product teams in the past and growth teams in the past, if we ran an experiment that drove top line ARR by half a percentage point, it was the best thing we did all year. And we're going out to Alexander's and we're having a big meal. And so if you can come in and say, well, actually involuntary churn can be 10x that impact if you focus on it correctly and you prioritize it correctly, I think the market would say, I need to prioritize that. But I think the first and most foundational answer to your question around why companies aren't really running after it is they know it exists, but they just don't think it's that big because teams don't really look into that. And similarly, again, as you go back to search and recommendations teams everywhere, they all look at latency and they look at recommendation success. And the metrics are kind of the same across the board. Payments teams across the board, they're not the same. Sometimes they don't exist. Sometimes they're the biggest org, but sometimes they're just one person. And sometimes we don't even track the core authorization metrics. So that's scratching the surface. But I would say foundationally, it's an awareness problem. And then even when you get past the awareness problem, it becomes an incredibly difficult problem to solve. And I'm happy to spend a lot more time there diving into that. But that's the very, very high level.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. And I would like to go into the specific. So remembering that there's a lot of lay people here in the audience who may not be in the payments team, but might be more generalists or leading other parts of the organization. What are some of the tactics that chip away at a big involuntary churn number? I understand that it's a lot of little things that add up to that 5% of ARR. What are some of those elements?
Totally. So I would say several things. The first thing that makes it particularly difficult to solve is that there is no 80-20 rule for solving failed payments. When we talked up front, kind of brought up my aha moment. And my aha moment was, wow, these engineering optimal cron jobs actually result in some payments being flagged for fraud. And we can anticipate this and see this in our minds because we can say, if somebody did take my card and swiped it at 1 a.m, I don't think it would go through. And so we can think about that particular use case. But like I said, there's lots and lots of reasons why payments fail. So if you're trying to chip away at the problem, let's start to break it down a little bit. The first thing we need to do, we need to identify the volume of payments that have failed in the last year. Then we need to go categorize them. And at a very high level, we can put them into two categories. We can say hard errors, and these are the things that should not be retried and cannot be fixed. And hard errors include things like a stolen card. Hard errors include things like actual fraud. When we see those cases and we get those error codes back, we don't want to try and fix that. We want to let that drop, not fixable. So then I need to go look at what portion of my failed payments are soft errors. And those are things that we can fix. Soft errors are things like processor error. Well, if there's a processor error, what do? We don't want to wait a week to go rerun the payment. We probably want to do it in a couple hours. So just differentiating between those two, soft versus hard, is somewhat difficult. As we talked up front, roughly 2/3 of payments errors are soft and retryable, but it's going to depend on your business, which means you need to go look into your data.
The example you gave at the beginning, the Bank of India midnight charge, would that be a soft error? Is that a process error because of the time of the processing?
Totally right. And it's tricky to go make those calls in real time because there's so much volume that's coming in, right? And particularly if you're a large, very, very large enterprise, you might get 50 failed payments just in the last hour alone. So if a human is going in trying to categorize and do all of that, that's really, really difficult to do. And so ultimately, what you really need to do is build a system to figure that out in real time, to address that in real time, which is very, very difficult. But let's assume that you don't have a machine learning function in-house and you don't have a cloud platform to go make those decisions. Well, what else can you do? The first thing you would do if you're savvy is go into your payment service provider, like an Adyen or a Stripe or a Braintree, and just start to look at the error codes, right? Look at the reasons that are being given for why the payments are failing. And you can, again, make some progress here. So you might find, again, some of these things that say processor error, or some of these things that say generic failure. Some of these things might say stolen card. Some of these things might say have raw acquirer codes associated with them. And the reason why it becomes really difficult to make sense of all of those error codes is because each of the payment service providers are rolling up the error codes from the downstream issuers. And when I say the issuers, I mean the banks. And when I say the banks, I'm talking about Wells Fargo. I'm talking about Chase. I'm talking about PNC. I'm talking about Banamex. I'm talking about BBVA Bancomer, Bancolombia, Carte Bancaire. There's over 1,000 different banks in the world. And the problem is all of those banks have their own rules. And the problem is that those rules are not unified. So when you go into a dashboard, for instance, within a Stripe or an Adyen, and you see something that says generic failure, you are not able to make sense of that because it means something different depending on whether that payment failure came from an issuer in France versus an issuer in Colombia. And so high level, that gets really difficult to break down. And now if you actually do understand the volume of failed payments, you can differentiate well between hard and soft, and you can start to understand the actual issuer level error response. This is when you can start to think about the strategy. And the strategy is the timing and the metadata. Timing, knowing what time to run the transaction to maximize the likelihood of success. Metadata, meaning what fields should I present with the authorization? And if you're wondering, what does that mean? Well, there's actually up to 128 different data elements you can present when you're transacting on a card. Most businesses are presenting it one way. But let's just take one of those elements. For instance, a zip code. Well, if I go look at a Barclays issued card from the UK, the zip code format is different than when I'm looking at, you and I are both in the Bay Area, and we have Chase issued cards. Well, there's 5 digits involved there, or depending on how much complexity we want, 5 digits plus 4 digits. So we could do something like 94115, or it could be formatted as 94115-1719 to go 5 plus 4. But then if that was a Barclays issued card, it would have to include some J's and some C's and some K's and some characters. So now there's that element to consider. And it gets really, really hard, really, really fast to consider all that complexity for every payment failure in every case from every issuer. So there are ways that you can start to address the problem and start to get better. And the first step, of course, is to say, well, let me just try and group the world into soft versus hard. Let me try and do a little bit better on the soft errors. And maybe getting a little bit better means saying, well, at least I'll run the cards at 12 noon local time. And I'll try and do a little bit of that intermixing to look into my data to see if there's more to uncover. But you also get to a point where you say, if you want to get an A+ on the test, you've got to build a machine learning platform to go figure some of this stuff out.
I know you guys talk about friction-free fixes. What is a friction-free fix? And what doesn't that include in terms of this big pool of rejected payments?
For sure. So one of the things that you want to think about when you're thinking about friction-free fixes is that, again, it's part of the canonical knowledge on payment failure, is that when there's a payment failure event, I need to go text my user, I should go email my user, I should essentially harass them, right? The payment's failed, and so let's get to Robbie and make sure she updates it. When we talk about friction-free, what we basically mean is to say that, well, hopefully we've identified and clarified for several of the folks here, that in many cases, we don't need to be calling Robbie or texting Robbie. And it's annoying for us to put that onus on our customer to go fix the payment failure when it can be something that we can actually simply do ourselves by cleaning up our own backend. And so when we're talking about friction-free, what we're trying to say is most payment failures are remediable without end user intervention. I don't actually need to reach out to the customer or make the customer do something. And this is something that the industry doesn't understand. The industry thinks that all of these payment failure cases, I need Robbie and Vijay to go call up their bank and go fix a problem that they've created. And they're not acknowledging that actually I've created the problem and I can fix it without that end user intervention. So what we like to do is make sure that for that 70% of payment failures that is actually fixable, take that out of the bucket of customer support, take that out of the bucket of emails, take that out of the bucket of notifications. You know, I can say I myself as a consumer, I get annoyed when that stuff happens to me because you could have just fixed it for me. And so take that bucket out. And then for cases where legitimately you need a user to actually update their credentials or actually go to a bank or actually be notified that there's fraud happening, then be very selective around how you do that. And so that's what we're talking about when we say friction-free. And the other element that we wanted to really address when we're talking about friction-free is to say that there are businesses that don't do this level of differentiation between fixable payment failure and non-fixable payment failure. And so instead, you can actually go overboard on the other side of the problem. And going overboard on the other side of the problem is to not understand that actually by not being nuanced, if you see a payment failure and every single time you try to recover it 10 to 15 times, which I've seen a lot of businesses do, because now they're like, oh, Vijay, you have convinced me. This is a big problem. Here's my way of investing in it. Slam payment retries. Just run the payment over and over and over again. And they're like, what's the downside? Right? Because they're like, well, if the payment's failed and he owes me the money, then I should just keep trying to run the card. No. There is a downside there. Number one, you're creating friction for the customer, which should be the only reason I need to give you, right? that you're running Robbie's card 20, 25 times, and it's failing and it's failing and it's failing, and they're getting these notifications, that's a problem. But even if you're not convinced by that, there's actually a downside to over attempting to retry failed payments, which is that the transaction authorization rate goes down. And if the transaction authorization rate goes down, the banks, the issuers, the downstream networks start to see your business as a shady merchant. Because they say, wait a minute, is your business a hub for card testing? Is that why so many payments are failing? And because of that, they actually start to penalize you. And they say, hey, when I think about accepting or rejecting a card payment, I'm going to make the rules harsher now because your business as a shadier merchant. And so that's the nuance that comes to this problem, is that friction-free means let's go solve the problems that are fixable without calling up our customers. It also means do not overdo it when it comes to trying to solve the problem. Because if you overdo it, there's a downside, there's a negative feedback loop that's created there, not just for the customer, but also for your business and your bottom line. And that's where nuance needs to come into play.
Super interesting. And I want to just stay on this topic of friction-free versus when you have to communicate with the customer, with the subscriber, in that the messages at a minimum are annoying, but they can also be hurtful. When, if I say to you, like, even the language of your payment failed, right? It implies that you did something wrong, and that it's not just something wrong, but something dishonest. And I think even if it's fixed, I know that in many cases, that consumer has changed their attitude about the company. And they said, this is a company that doesn't trust me. And in our world of subscriptions, trust is everything, right? This is all about a relationship where someone's automatically charging your payment, your credit card, or whatever your payment method, they're charging it automatically without touching base with you first. And so the level of trust and goodwill has to be really high.
Totally agreed. And I think it leaves a bad taste in a consumer's mouth, because the best practice, and it's not a best practice, I shouldn't call it a best practice, it's a standard practice. Standard practice is not necessarily best practice, as this industry really shows you. But the standard practice today is every time I run Robbie's card and it doesn't go through, I tie an email to it. And in that email, I say, hi, Robbie, your payment failed. You need to go fix it. Which, like you said, is putting the responsibility on you to go fix the card and saying, hey, you are presenting fraudulent information. But we've all had that experience where we're like, I didn't do anything wrong. This is my card. Why is it being declined? You've particularly had that experience if you've tried to sign up for something cross-border, maybe a service or product that's headquartered somewhere else. And that does violate trust. It tells the consumer that you're not taking responsibility for the issue that you have created. And we see, because of that, if a user ultimately gets involuntary churn from a service, in 75% of cases, they never sign back up for that service. And that's a question that I get quite a bit, which is, well, like, even if they get churned, if they really like the service, wouldn't they just go sign back up? It's not that simple. And the reason for that is because they've lost trust in your service. And so there's generally other alternatives out there for them to consider. And so if I've lost trust in Box, I might go to Dropbox because of a payment failure related issue that has nothing to do with how I appreciated the product or not. And so that's what you need to be mindful and wary of when you're working with your customers. And I'll say, I saw that firsthand. And part of the motivation for starting my business was, you know, at large companies, when we see high volumes of payment failure, we tend to put it on the customer. Well, we say, hey, like, why are 80% of Indian payments failing? Or why is India a small market? Or why is Indonesia a small market? And we say, well, it's because they don't want to pay for the service. They don't have a propensity to pay. I'm a well-traveled guy. I know people all over the world want to read books and people all over the world want to play games. It's not that simple. Right. And so if we're not setting up in a way that these people can actually pay us, and then we're just throwing up our hands and say, well, they don't want to pay, we're missing out on lots of volume and lots of opportunity. Because the reality is, when you do address these fundamental issues, I can guarantee if you address some fundamental payments issues, for instance, providing local payment methods, people don't pay by card in these places. They might pay by direct carrier billing or otherwise. Put that into your product flows. Give them a way to pay that's not US-centric, that allows them to pay, and then come back and tell me if their volume has spiked or not. And I can say I've seen that firsthand, right? Just by introducing a way for users to pay you, you can make those markets become top five overnight because the demand was already there. The ability just wasn't. So take away the onus from it's your fault to how can I make it easier for someone to come in and pay for the service?
So I guess the moral of the story is that the payments department is actually a pretty powerful department to be in if you want to have a big impact on revenue growth.
I think that's right. And there's, I would argue, it's the single biggest lever towards revenue growth. Because you would know, on the other hand, what's the reputation of payments? It's slow, there's minor improvements, it's basis points, little optimal, maybe small little optimizations that you can make. And I'm like, no. Like, this is the singular biggest revenue driver for organization. I've made a career out of it. This is why I'm in this industry, right? Because there's not a whole lot of other things that you can put on your product roadmap that literally bleed 10% of your top line and that can give you 5 to 10 points back to top line revenue. And if you think about what solving involuntary churn does for your business, it really means you're improving your LTV to CAC and you're flowing through to your contribution margin. And what it means is that businesses that are contracting, even top level, you're contracting from a top level perspective. If you solve downstream payment failure and you improve that LTV to CAC ratio and you improve those contribution margins, your CMO now has money to go spend on new acquisition channels and go fix the top of funnel problem. But if you completely ignore that downstream, then you're going to have two problems, which is that in a global macroeconomic downturn, you're going to have a harder time with acquisition. But now, because you haven't solved downstream, you certainly are not going to have that money to go invest in upstream and acquisition channels and otherwise. And so I think it's the singular biggest thing you can do to drive revenue. And, you know, you're essentially, I view myself as on a mission of bringing awareness and shedding a light on that and having subscription organizations start to realize this and invest the proper levels of investment that they should be making in solving this problem.
It's fascinating. And payments, the involuntary churn piece that you work on and solve it at Butter, as well as your kind of offhand point about have the right payment method for the local market before you say they don't want to pay. First, make sure they're able to pay before you decide whether they want to pay or not. It's such an important area of your subscription strategy. And I'm so delighted that you joined us today. Before I let you go, do you have time for a speed round?
Let's do it.
Okay. First subscription you ever had?
Ooh, first subscription. Honestly, so I was very OG Xbox Live. So that's actually a very full circle for me. So early Halo 1 probably would have been like 2005 or so. It was probably the first one that I had.
Favorite subscription you're using right now?
Spotify for me is my go-to. Use it every day. Podcasts, 1 hour commute, Bay Area traffic. It keeps my sanity.
You wrote a book, A Brown Man in Russia. What motivated you to write it? And what advice do you have for other would-be memoirists?
That is a great question. So big reader myself, big writer and big backpacker. So prior to starting to Butter, today people are aware of these cheap flight finders like Scott's Cheap Flights. But back in the day, you had to kind of do the heavy lifting yourself. And so I would change my geolocation to figure out the best prices and the best flights, the best places to go. And I did end up going to Russia with a backpack in the winter of 2013. Someone who grew up in California, that actually was the first time I'd seen snow in my life. So a little bit of a crazy experience. Went third class the whole way, took it all the way across from St. Petersburg, ended up ultimately in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. I had a series of crazy experiences. I think my takeaway from that was travel not to a place that's unique to you, but where you are unique to the place. Kind of call that my golden rule of travel, because when you do that, you create experiences out of thin air. You know, everyone comes to you and is like, what the hell are you doing here? Which creates connection and experiences and really burns down a lot of understanding. When it comes to people that want to write a memoir, for me, I would say it wasn't planned. I'd given a TED talk on it and a publisher approached me and said, hey, this would make for a good book, which led to the book. But if you are a memoirist out there, really like actually sitting down and scheduling time to write, right, is what you have to do. So I would do 4 hour blocks every weekend and 1 hour blocks every day. And I would just force my ass into a seat and just start writing. But I would also say, like, keep a journal, keep a diary and a couple notes every day that just reminds you of times and places and the idea will come to you.
If you want to be a writer, rule number one is start writing. Last question. You've said you believe in karma and in paying it forward. How does that manifest in your life today?
In so many ways, because I think coming in to start this company, a lot of people start companies because they have always had that dream, serial entrepreneur, or I come from an entrepreneurship background, or it just sounds like wanting to run your thing is what you want to do. I don't come from that world. I don't have serial entrepreneurship within my family or background, not a very risk-taking group or culture. I ended up here because of the favor of lots of different people that recognized some of my talent over at Microsoft and were able to spotlight me. Moving into Dropbox was a function of a very serendipitous meeting that I was able to take with actually Vinod Khosla way back And so lots of very different meetings and interactions that I had in even starting this company and getting acquainted with J.D. Ross, who was the founder of Opendoor, who I didn't have context with, but who a friend of a friend introduced me to. And we had a very similar conversation to the one you and I are having right now, Robbie, where he just kind of asked me and picked my brain on all of these things that I knew about payment failure and said, holy crap, I think you should start this company. And that resulted in me actually saying no for a month or two before deciding, you know what, I'm actually going to go out and do it. And of course, since there, things have taken off and we've built an amazing product in the market and solved a real need and are growing like wildfire, and I never would change anything for the world. So I would say to me, it has manifested a role in my life that these serendipitous meetings and these favors that people have done to acknowledge things that I've delivered have resulted in me being able to have this platform and this stage. And so for me, that's very, very important as well, to continue to give others opportunities who may come from more non-traditional entrepreneurship backgrounds, but may have a lot to offer, right? Literally know more about a certain space or domain or niche or have something to offer the world, and maybe you're not thinking through, well, maybe I'm the person to do it and why not me? So I think everyone should just embrace that mentality a little bit more. And if you're in a position of power, be able to have those conversations with people so that they can start to challenge themselves, say, well, yeah, why not me? I should be the one to go run that and do that. And so that has played a huge part of my life, and that's why I'm a believer in it.
Appreciate that. That's such wise counsel, and the idea of recognizing talent in others who might not see it yet, an opportunity for them, is one of the most generous acts I think that you can commit. This has been a wonderful, wonderful conversation, Vijay. Thank you so much. I hope to have you back on the show sometime soon, and really appreciate you taking the time and being so thoughtful with our listeners today.
I likewise appreciate it, and thank you so much for having me, and hope we were able to share a couple of gems that get people thinking. I'm happy to have anyone contact myself. Easy to find me, Vijay Butter Payments, after the show. Thanks so much, Robbie.
Perfect. We'll put it in the show notes. And thanks again, Vijay.
Thank you very much.
That was Vijay Menon, the founder and CEO at Butter Payments. For more about Vijay and Butter, go to butterpayments.com. And for more about subscription stories, as well as a transcript of my conversation with Vijay, go to robbiekelmanbaxter.com/podcast. Also, I have a favor to ask. If you like what you heard, please take a minute to go over to Apple Podcasts or Apple iTunes and leave a review. Mention Vijay and this episode if you especially enjoyed it. Reviews are how listeners find our podcast, and we appreciate each one. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening to Subscription Stories.